My special guest today is Professor Peter Teddy, who is a neurosurgeon at Royal Melbourne Hospital and also in private practice here in Melbourne. Thank you for your time, Professor. Now, you've written a piece on neurosurgical intervention for intransigent pain. Could you tell us a little bit about what neurosurgical intervention looked like in, say, the early 80s or the late 70s? What was it like then, and what's changed since?
Well, very largely it was so-called ablative surgery, making lesions in some part of the nervous, in some part of the pain pathways, to try and ameliorate pain. And this, the targets could be anywhere from the peripheral nerves right through to the thalamus and to the cortex. These were irreversible operations, sometimes quite risky, and mainly used, or very often used, in treating not non-malignant pain or benign pains, but very largely for the patients with terminal carcinoma. They were generally uncontrolled, because it was hard to do controlled studies, if you like, on patients with terminal disease. But they appeared to work well. I did a lot myself, a lot of chordotomies, some peripheral rhizolyses, and some myelotomies. And these were seemingly giving quite good results for the length of time for which the patients survived, which was usually somewhere between about 6 months and a year. There were a lot of problems associated with these conditions. They could get long-term recurrence if they survived that long. They could get post-operative dysesthesias, phantom pains, and these could be very hard to treat. But by and large, these were the things which were being done. They could be either open operations or percutaneous. To some extent, open operations gave way to percutaneous operations because they were deemed to be safer, and you were less invasive of a person who was perhaps in a precarious state. Then, gradually, over the years, following on the work of Maltsak and Wall and the gate theory in 1967 or 66, a neurosurgeon in the States, Norman Shealy, operated on several patients with terminal cancer with pelvic and lower limb pains using spinal cord stimulation. This seemed to be pretty successful in those patients, and so it led to a widespread use of trying spinal cord stimulation, whereby put a couple of electrodes in those days directly onto the spinal cord and applied a small stimulating current. The idea was to try and swamp the, if you like, the messages going up through the small fibres up through the spinal cord, spinothalamic tract, and influence the dorsal horns, and to reduce the amount of pain perception and pain being felt by the patient, and maybe their attitude towards it.
So there's a psychological effect as well.
There could be a psychological effect as well, yeah. So this gave way to a very widespread use of spinal cord stimulation for a whole pile of pathologies that probably weren't appropriate. And with the problems that there were in those days, putting electrodes directly onto the spinal cord, there were problems with CSF leaks, infections, many, many technical problems. And the devices themselves weren't particularly well developed. And then in the 1990s, there was a resurgence of the technique and the application of this. People learned a bit more when to apply the devices, when what wasn't going to work, what was. And the biggest advances were putting the electrodes in the epidural space, and also the technology improved, really pushed along by the cardiologists and with cardiac pacing, with similar devices being used mm-hmm. in many ways. And so again, there was a resurgence then in the 2000s. Into this kind of treatment, not just with spinal cord stimulation, but with peripheral nerve stimulation, and perhaps to a lesser extent, deep brain stimulation as well. The problem is always finding appropriate targets in the brain, and also, again, appropriate application of this kind of technology in a wide variety of patients.
What's the data like? What's the evidence like for DBS and other stimulation
models? DBS, I'd say it's modest. And the most commonly applied techniques have been those of either spinal cord stimulation or peripheral nerve stimulation. The problem is that the data, again, still is not conclusive. And the reason for this is that most kinds of stimulators that have been put in produce a paresthesia. And so the patients have been able to tell almost invariably when the thing is on and when it's off. There's been a mixture of work cover cases and non-industrial conditions. And again, this has been somewhat a problem in producing bias in results, and it's been to a large extent inconclusive. About 2004, I think it was, there was a paper which showed a comparison between spinal cord stimulation and repeat surgery in cases of failed back syndrome, back surgery syndrome. The results of that did appear to show that there was a good response from spinal cord stimulation. Certainly it was better than reoperating. And there was some evidence as well following on from that to show that there was this was a cost-effective or more cost-effective way of dealing with the problem. The real problem still with all manner of neuromodulation, which is what this is a part of, is that there's never been an effective trial run using placebo-controlled trials or sham-controlled trials against cord or other forms of stimulation. And this has been because of the problem with paresthesia. But what's happened now is that in the last couple of years, we've got a better, we have the methodology of being able to do that. There have been two recent advances in cord stimulation, not so much with the gadgetry, but with the type of stimulation being applied. And so one system which has come along uses ultra-high frequency stimulation at 10,000 hertz instead of the usual kind of 40 to 200. And this produces paresthesia-free stimulation. And there's another type of stimulation which is applied now, which is a kind of phasic stimulation, or burst stimulation, which can have the same kind of effect. So we now have the means of being able to compare cord stimulation versus the conventional, or the conventional cord stimulation versus high frequency or burst stimulation versus placebo. As yet, no really convincing trials have been done. And so we're still in the same position whereby the whole methodology has never yet been fully proven. And we all have lots of instances of patients who appear perfectly rational, very sensible people, without any hang-ups from psychological issues, with no motivation, social or psychological issues, who do seem to do spectacularly well following the application of one form of neuromodulation or another. I've got them myself. I've put in plenty of these things. But I still would like to know very much indeed whether these things really have a very genuine major therapeutic effect, whether they're kind of just marginally beyond placebo.
Is it just that nobody's had the time to run a trial, or are there practical problems involved in trying to run a trial like that?
There are practical problems. Some of them, I think, are more theoretical than real. The trial which is most recently carried out did compare high-frequency stimulation against another well-known normal stimulation device, and came out very firmly in response of the high-frequency stimulation being something like 30% better than both for back and lower limb pains. And of course, treatment of back pain is the holy grail of this kind of
Indeed.
Treatment. But it didn't compare it against a sham, and this is what really does need to be done.
We just published, just this week, a piece from Lee Atkinson on spinal fusion surgeries. What's your take on that in terms of overuse or not?
I think there are two things. I think Lee is quite right in much of what he said.
Yep.
Equally, there's a book which has just recently been published by Ian Harris, Surgery, the Ultimate Placebo. And that makes fascinating reading, and I think a very large proportion of what he says is absolutely correct. It's not just spinal fixation surgery which is the problem. I mean, properly done and for the right reasons, and many of my colleagues do it really expertly, with no problem at all. You can look at the scans afterwards and they're perfect. Surgery has been conducted in a very efficient and proficient manner. But the patient isn't necessarily any better. The ones I see coming in my clinic are not. The problem I've got, of course, is I see probably only a fairly small number of the patients which are operated on altogether. And so I've got no clear idea as to exactly how many of these cases are doing a great deal of good. But from all that I read, it's fairly considerable. And I do think that way too much spinal fusion surgery is being done. But the problem is, as well, I think too much neuromodulation is being done as well. And we have to find a balance, and we have to look at it really thoroughly and investigate it properly to see if we can get a handle on just when we should be doing these things. And it's like everything else in surgery, patient selection is the key.
Yeah. Lee Atkinson suggested a national audit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think there should be a national registry for spinal fusion surgery and for neuromodulation. I mean, they're the two arms of trying to treat the same very gross problem.
You mentioned in your paper that there are less than 10 neurosurgeons in Australia and New Zealand who specialise in pain. Why is that? Why is it such a small proportion of neurosurgeons?
I think it's not a glamour specialty. I mean, I've done in my career just about everything in neurosurgery that I can do. And compared some of the stuff I used to do, aneurysms and intrinsic cord tumours and syringomyelia, it's technically not as demanding. And,
sure.
And it's not the kind of thing that the trainees are, you know, yearning to go into.
It's not interesting because it's such a huge problem.
It is a huge problem and it needs to be dealt with. And I don't think it should be divorced from neurosurgery mainstream. I think it's far better that any neurosurgeon getting involved does mainstream neurosurgery as well, but may have a very definite specialist interest in it.
Is there enough dedicated to it in their training?
No, I don't think so. At the moment, there's a poor understanding. It takes a long time to get used to some of these patients, and you can imagine the clinics are full of people that take a while to get sorted. Another of the more recent advances, we think, is that of dorsal root ganglion stimulation. We thought the dorsal root ganglion was a kind of passive conduit for pain or other afferent impulses. It appears now to have an active function in that. And for things like complex regional pain syndrome or post-herniorrhaphy pain, foot pain, it does appear to be beneficial as far as we can tell, but it's early days. We've only done relatively few of them.
What would you do right now if you could?
For back pain?
Yeah.
I think the first thing that really needs to be thoroughly looked at is just, as I said, patient selection. The thing that probably irritates me most are the young patients, otherwise physically fit, with back pain of maybe a year or so's duration. An MRI, no abnormal neurology, no sciatica in fact, or other leg pains. An MRI that just shows a couple of dark discs. And to see them going off to have one, two or three level fusions is pretty not the way I would go. So I think that needs to be addressed in the first, one of the things that I'd like to see addressed. The other is just some really good basic clinical scientific work to establish once and for all just how useful some of these therapies are.
What role does patient expectation play in all of this?
I think it's huge. I think of the devices I put in, certainly a number that appears spectacularly successful, I'm sure in my own mind that working from a largely as a placebo, but not entirely, I don't think, but it could be a fairly large proportion. And there is little doubt that the patient's expectations are ramped up by explanation or adequate explanation sometimes. And also putting these devices in, we have a lot of help from industry, and programmers come along and help us to work these devices on a longer term basis. And much of the work they do is very, very helpful and buoy up the patients and keep them going. How much of it is actually the electrons passing up the gadgets, and how much of it is the input from the psychologists and from the looking after from day to day, it hasn't yet been determined.
Thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.